You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Alan Marinus, founder of the Modern Musar Movement and author of the new book, The Shabbat Effect. We'll also have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. I returned recently from a rabbinic trip to Israel, and I can tell you that, thank God, Israel again feels like Israel. When I visited in January of 2024 at one of the worst moments of the recent war, I found that Israel that seemed like the same place I've lived in and loved, but in other ways was having a national PTSD experience. Posters of missing hostages back then were everywhere. Video boards cycled through the faces and names and ages. Billboards and bumper stickers and assembled monuments and performance art displays were constant reminders of the missing Israelis. And then there were the many memorials to the murdered teenagers, elderly, children, mothers, and fathers, all brutally murdered by the Palestinian terrorists of Hamas and Islamic Jihad on and after October 7th. But this time, we couldn't help but notice after we landed that Ben-Gurion Airport no longer had photos of kidnapped hostages lining the long arrival hallway as you entered. And the plethora of posters and video boards calling for the immediate repatriation of the hostages, they're nearly all gone from the city streets of Israel. What an incredible relief. During our time in the capital, Jerusalem, we had lectures and discussions at the Foreign Ministry. We met the Minister of Tourism, Chaim Katz, member of Knesset Moshe Torpaz, a leader of the opposition, visited the new Knesset Museum, met with officials deeply involved in Israel's current strategic and security situations. At the Foreign Ministry, we had a roundtable with members of the department who are charged with public relations, Hasbara. And there, we rabbis, as you might expect, offered feedback and suggestions. In another session, we were briefed on the regional challenges that face Israel by an impressive director of a department, including how Israel plans to go forward in confronting Iran. And in a discussion with the official in the Foreign Ministry charged with combating the rising global anti-Semitism, we discussed how we as rabbis can address the growing generational divide in attitudes towards Israel. Complementing those sessions at the Foreign Ministry and the Knesset, we had impassioned talks by Michal Kotler-Wunsch, the anti-Semitism director for Israel until just a month ago, and British journalist and author Melody Phillips about the state of Jewish and world affairs. As the representatives of the Foreign Ministry briefed us, until now Israel has successfully battled a 7-front war. 1. Fighting Hamas in Gaza. 2. Fighting Hezbollah in Lebanon. 3. In Syria, fighting first the Syrians under Assad and their deployed Iranian military units, and then the post-Assad militias. 4. The Houthis in Yemen. 5. Hamas and Islamic Jihad in the West Bank. 6. The Shiite militias in Iraq, who fired missiles and drones at Israel. And finally, number 7, Iran itself, the malign supporter behind all the fronts, which at one point, of course, directly attacked Israel. 2 points, to be honest. On all fronts, remarkably, and in some cases nearly miraculously, on all those 7 fronts, Israel has triumphed militarily. That is a profound geostrategic difference between the Israel I visited 21 months ago and the current nation. But Melody Phillips and Michal Kotler-Wunsch spoke of an 8th front in this war. The attacks on Israel in the media and public spaces, the efforts to ostracize and delegitimize Israel, and intimidate and demonize Jews all over the world. The war being waged against Israel, Israelis, and Jews in this eighth sphere is well-organized, well-financed, pervasive. We rabbis of the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition were encouraged by the Israelis to have a greater understanding that we have a responsibility to lead in this all-important battle for public opinion. I think we kind of knew that. It became painfully clear during our meetings and conversations at the Foreign Ministry, at the Ministry of Tourism, at the Knesset, that the leaders of Israel, and in particular this Netanyahu government, have no overall strategy to address the virulent spread of anti-Semitism that has gone everywhere in the world now. They are in many ways in Israel just coming to terms with this virulent spread of the pandemic of anti-Semitism and the ways that we Jews are being attacked and intimidated, including through violence all around the world today. The department in Israel that addresses anti-Semitism at the Foreign Ministry consists of, well, one person, which she made painfully clear to us. While the responsibility to address the many slurs, conspiracy theories, and waves of anti-Semitic hatred launched from the political left and right at Jews and Israelis everywhere, well, that's a shared responsibility with the Jews of the diaspora in Tucson, just as in New York or Los Angeles, it certainly would seem that the Israeli government needs to focus on this issue in a much more serious way. It has not done so yet. We can only assume that now that the full-on war is definitively over, that's certainly how Israelis are looking at the war, it is time for leadership on this crucial issue to come from the nation with more than half the world's Jews as its residents and much of its talent and leadership ability. Our visit to the Gaza envelope was painful, but informative and at times inspiring. In a moving ceremony, we visited first the site of the Nova Festival to recite Kaddish and El Mole Rachamim and sing HaTikva and walk quietly over the sacred ground. It is cleaned up now. In place of blood everywhere, you see the photos and biographies of each of the young people murdered by the Hamas Palestinian terrorists on that awful Simchat Torah day in 2023. So many promising lives cut short brutally in terrible ways. It hurts the heart. Over 5,000 people every single day visit the Nova Festival site now. It's just a couple of miles from Gaza, and the highway next to it, the one that became the death trap that day, also has its visitors. Nova has become the central memorial. There are others, of course. We visited a few. But Nova is the central memorial now of October 7th, 2023. Accompanied by a VIP escort from the IDF, our group also went to areas not usually available to the public. We saw trucks lined up on both sides of the Keren Shalom crossing into Gaza and learned from the old-timey Sabra director of operations, crusty guy, that it takes 100 trucks a day filled with food to feed Gaza. Israel is sending in 800 trucks a day, none on Shabbat, but 800 the other 6 days of the week, 4,800 trucks a week. These trucks originate in Jordan or Egypt, filled to the brim with supplies for Gaza. Now, reminder, what is required to feed the population of Gaza is just 100 trucks. 800 trucks are going every day. We saw the enormous line of them ferrying food and medical supplies and clothing to Gaza, unloading the material to be picked up by Palestinian trucks on the other side of the border in Gaza. The Israelis search every truck that goes in and confiscate contraband weapons, explosives, and chemicals that can be made into rocket fuel. These are often hidden in toys, food cans, and packages. We also saw a display of some of these confiscated materials, extensive display of it. In any case, a huge quantity of supplies are regularly pouring into Gaza. Frankly, they've been pouring in all along without cessation during the Gaza war. Israel has not interdicted the food supply at any time. Starvation in Gaza, if it occurred, was not the result of a lack of food crossing through the Keren Shalom border post into the Gaza territory. I can't remember another war in which the combatants were supposed to feed the other side. Israel did it. The problem is what happens once the aid gets to the other side, to Gaza and the Palestinians. There, the United Nations is anything but helpful, and Hamas, and to a lesser extent, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, violently seek to abscond and control the distribution of food and medical supplies, and they gouge their own Gaza-Palestinian people for the food they sell them, offering it to them at usurious rates, or they simply hoard it for the use of their own terrorists. In fact, just a half an hour before we arrived, we were told, a terrorist who had attacked one of the kibbutzim on October 7, 2023, and who was now part of a convoy driving the trucks, was captured using facial recognition by the Israelis. It was a stark reminder that Israel remains vigilant and determined to apprehend any and every Gaza-Palestinian who participated in the war crimes of October 7, 2023. A somber moment took place when we went to visit the Nahal Oz base. It's unusual permission we were granted. There, the female Tatzpitaniot, the observers, were overrun and destroyed. We heard the story from one of their colleagues, saw the site where brave young female IDF observers were murdered in cold blood and burned alive. Others were violated and abused, some taken hostage. Through our tears, meeting the young soldiers stationed in the region and witnessing their idealistic determination to defend their country and their people, all while seeking peace, soothed some of the pain and was inspiring. We met as well with lone Israeli soldiers, young men and women who come from the diaspora and have no immediate family in Israel but feel called to defend the Jewish people. Most were combat soldiers who've served multiple tours in Gaza. One of the most eye-opening observations came from a very bright and thoughtful young man from the U.S. who said that what shocked him the most during the war was discovering that in the tunnels, the most common book found amidst the Hamas terrorist possessions was the Arabic translation of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. That's right. This has been confirmed broadly by both the IDF and independent international media and other observers. If there was any doubt about the motivation of the Islamists of Hamas, their circulation of the Arabic translation of Mein Kampf should put it to rest. Hamas's goal is the destruction, the mass murder, the genocide of all Jews in the world. It is Nazi ideology turned into Islamist creed. It was from these young people, however, that the most hopeful note emerged. It came humorously from a slight young blonde woman soldier who studied at a Jewish women's high school quite near where I grew up and where my parents lived until 2019 in Los Angeles. This young soldier could not be taller than 5'2" at best. When she volunteered for the Israeli military, she was worried she would be considered underweight and not be accepted. She actually took a couple of hand weights and put them into her pockets when she went for her medical exam, trying to fool the scale and the tough IDF examiners. When in a long line of women, her turn finally came to step on the scale, miraculously, the scale failed, didn't work. They tried a few times and then just waved her on. It did work for the next woman. Well, this soldier took it as a sign that it was bashert for her to be there. None of these young soldiers entered the IDF service for anything but the motivation to protect Jews, the Jewish people, and the Jewish nation. They ranged from modern Orthodox Jews to secular Jews, serving in units ranging from intelligence to naval commandos. All stressed that in operations they were instructed to and acted to prevent civilian casualties at all times among the Palestinians. All were incredibly inspiring, idealistic, but pragmatic and realistic, having faced hard combat and reflecting the values and energy that should make any Jew proud. Like nearly every Jew in the world, I have relatives in Israel. I stayed with a couple one night in Jerusalem and visited another in Tel Aviv, and I can tell you, none of them are fans of Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. All of them believe there must be an independent Israeli inquiry into the responsibility for October 7th having occurred at all. And some of them believe the war was carried on much too far and too long for political purposes. That's the point of a democracy. You get to disagree with the government, especially when you believe it's wrong. They have that in Israel. I hope we recover that ability here in America soon. Look, my friends, it is Israel again. traffic jams and public rallies, high prices and great food, ancient archaeology and the most advanced high tech, music and dance and theater and art, constant new building and infrastructure and transportation projects, magnificent new museums and endless remodeling, chaotic, beautiful, extraordinary. May Israel see true peace soon and always. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest is an old friend, Professor Alan Marinus, founder of the Modern Musar Movement, who has a new book out explaining how Shabbat enhances our lives. Find out all about it when he joins us in a moment on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish a friend and teacher, Dr. Alan Marinus, who is really responsible as much as anyone for the modern Musar movement in contemporary Judaism. He has a new book out about Shabbat called The Shabbat Effect. His doctorate comes from Oxford University. I'm sorry you couldn't get into a better school, really very disappointing, where he went on a Rhodes Scholarship. His books include Climbing Jacob's Ladder, Everyday Holiness, and With Heart and Mind. We've actually used a couple of them in our own Musar groups here at my congregation. I know they've been used by hundreds of congregations around the country and around the world. Good morning, Alan, and welcome back to Too Jewish.
Thank you, Rabbi. Good morning to you.
So why do we need a book about Shabbat now?
Well, I'm not sure why anybody needs one, except that I can say that I know I did. I've tracked my own journey of starting out in life with a very non-observant, non-Shabbat-focused life. And then over time, have come to realize that the 7 days a week can be very oppressive if there's no place to get a perspective that sees life other than just mass busyness. And our tradition has set out this one day a week where we can get a very different way of living. And that way of living, what I've learned, impacts the other 6 days of the week. So that's really what the focus of the book is, and what my hopeful contribution is to say that don't think of it as one day separate from the others, the other six. See it as one day that's like a laboratory or a workshop for developing qualities in you that then will have impact the other 6 days of the week as well.
You know, it seems to me that Shabbat was always challenged for particularly American Jews. When Jews were merchants and peddlers and stuff, Saturday was the day when you had to be open for the store. Later, that was the day when kids were playing sports and ballet, and that's when all the activities took place in the community. But we're in a kind of a different era now with the constant connectivity, and then feel a need always to check and to know what's going on, and messages coming in at all hours, all times.
Right.
Is that qualitatively different, do you think?
I do. You know, in the olden days, if you hadn't seen someone for a year, when you saw them, you recited the prayer about the resurrection of the dead. Yeah. Because, you know, people would leave Europe, they'd come to North America, they would have so little communication going back and forth that they really didn't know who was alive and who was dead. Now we can know everything at the touch of a finger and in an instant, and we feel so plugged in, we feel that that's become our dominant identity, is how we relate to others through media. And I was driving down the street the other day, and every time I got to a street corner, I noticed that every person standing on the corner was looking at their phone, one after another. And, you know, I say it as if I'm so surprised, but none of us is surprised by that anymore.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you were saying. I was looking at my phone.
Well, it's just so ironic that what we call these devices for connection actually serve to disconnect us.
We will talk much more with our guest, Dr. Alan Marinus, and particularly about the Shabbat and his new book, The Shabbat Effect, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established 7 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services. Come in person or on our Facebook page. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is going great for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with terrific Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Join us for Congregation Beit Simcha's Let There Be Light 7th Anniversary Celebration, Saturday, December 20th at 5 p.m. Music, latkes, food, drink, fun, gifts, and of course, menorah lighting. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up for the finest Hanukkah celebration in all of Arizona. All of our services, classes, and events at Beit Simcha are open to everybody. Come Friday night, services are at 6:30 p.m., Shabbat evening celebration services, followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat, always. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m., services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson, and you can go to our musical services by virtual experience, too. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, Let There Be Light, Hanukkah celebration, Bar Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services available on Facebook. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at Beit Simcha, the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both,
Our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470 to speak to a family advisor at Evergreen. Call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So I've come back recently from a trip to Azerbaijan and Israel, and I had never been in the Caucasus before. It was really an eye-opening experience. It's a fascinating area. It was temperate when I was there, warmer in Baku than it was in Tucson, Arizona, right on the Caspian Sea, beautiful, fascinating city. You, however, have spent a good amount of time in the Caucasus. Tell us about, I think your first trip is really an interesting story.
Right. Well, with pleasure. I have spent a strangely large amount of time in the Caucasus, going back to 1971, when I was still an undergrad and a teenager, in fact. And I took a semester off of university and sort of went by land across Asia. I kind of improvised. I went from Istanbul all the way to the south of India, then took a plane to Sri Lanka, spent some time there. But on the way, one of the many stops I made was in Israel, where I had several friends who were doing their Jewish year abroad at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And we sort of agreed that we would spend our Christmas break in the former Soviet Union, and that the way we would enter the former Soviet Union was on the very short flight from Kabul to Tashkent, Uzbekistan. So these guys flew, they didn't actually fly all the way to Kabul because you couldn't. In those days, there were decent relations between Israel and Iran. The Shah was still on the peacock throne. And you could fly on BOAC from Tel Aviv to Tehran. And then you took a series of buses and trains and whatever to reach Kabul. So I met those guys in Kabul, where I had worked assiduously for like at least a week, cultivating the woman who did sort of tourist stuff at the Soviet embassy in Kabul. It was a branch of Inturi, state-run travel agency at the time. And for some reason, she knew what was going on and that I was waiting for three friends to come from Israel. But she also knew how anti-Semitic her bureaucracy was. So on nationality, there was a little slip of the pen, and she put on all of our visas that we were Afghans. So at least the first few days of our visit to the former Soviet Union, security was very lax. We weren't followed by KGB agents. We weren't rigidly controlled. That changed once they caught on to the fact that we were not, in fact, Afghan nationals, but Americans. But the goal of that trip was to distribute Jewish prayer books and Hebrew Bibles and stuff like that to communities that got fewer visitors than communities closer to Western Europe, like Moscow and Leningrad got plenty of visitors from the West. But Tashkent and Bukhara and Samarkand, not so much. And what was interesting to me was that after several months in what was really Asia, like Afghanistan and Iran and Pakistan and India and Sri Lanka, some of these places. So you know what I mean when I say they're really Asian. Going to Baku felt like arriving in Europe. I think if you arrive from a month or two in Western Europe, it may feel more Asian. But at the time, it seemed very European, very prosperous, and it had this great history of lots of different communities, which is typical for seaports. It is a seaport, but it's an inland sea. It's a port on
Caspian. Right. You know,
but it felt in some ways like Thessaloniki because there were Jews and Muslims and Christians and Armenians. And that was, of course, before all the wars and massacres that then tore the region apart, both before and after the Soviet Union split up. It got much worse after the Soviet Union split up. And that was a period in which I returned to the Caucasus and actually lived there because I opened the U.S. Embassy in Armenia, and I served there as chef d'affaires for more than 20 months, nearly 2 years, till we actually got an ambassador in place and up and running. So in those days, I went to all three capitals of the Caucasus on a fairly regular basis. Now the only one I visit regularly is Tbilisi, because as you well know, I'm a wine guy, and Tbilisi is like one of the world's greatest cities for wine.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you, I was stunned and really enjoyed being in Baku. I'd like to go back. I want to see Georgia now and Armenia too. So I could understand the attraction and a lot to see. Interesting cultures, definitely a combination of Europe and Asia. Really interesting, different. And by the way, they tell us in Azerbaijan there's never been any anti-Semitism, that it just isn't an I knew there was some place on earth that you could say that about, but apparently that's true.
That was actually true in Armenia as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I always ask why there was virtually no Jewish community there, because
right.
The president's wife and son, David, were Jewish. David had a bar mitzvah when I was there.
Right.
But there was never much of a community, and they said it's because of all the Soviet republics, we're the one that didn't need Jews. What do you mean by that? Well, Jews are smart. They're good with numbers. They're good at accounting. They're great goldsmiths. They're great craftsmen. But that's true of Armenia, too. I mean, we recognize, this is the Armenian speaking now, we recognize three ancient worthy cultures, Greeks, Armenians, and Jews. And in Armenia, all three of those ethnic groups begin with a hard H.
Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A woman walks into the post office to buy stamps for Hanukkah cards. She says to the clerk, "May I have 50 Hanukkah stamps, please?" "What denomination?" asks the clerk. The woman answers, Oy vey, Izmir. My goodness, has it come to this? Fine. 6 Orthodox, 12 Conservative, and 32 Reform stamps. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. In a change of pace and literary emphasis within the text, Joseph will become the principal character of the last 4 weekly portions in Genesis. This is a kind of developmental transition to the long narrative of Moses that will fill the rest of the Torah, a more complete narrative, that is the Joseph one, than any that has preceded it so far in Genesis. The Joseph story has been called the first truly modern piece of literature, filled with contemporary authorial techniques in delineating character and plot. Each segment ends in a cliffhanger, and the interplay of storylines and locations makes the whole narrative vibrant and rich and exceedingly complex. The modernity of style is particularly impressive, since the book of Genesis was written at least 2,500 years ago, depicting events that are supposed to be 3,700 years old. This Joseph story stretches through a month of Torah readings. In the 4 weekly portions of Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, and Vayachi, we find temptation and cunning, nobility and baseness, carelessness and probity juxtaposed and then thoughtfully counterpointed. The foolish learn wisdom. The wicked grow to see the error of their ways. The impulsive learn restraint. And nothing is ever quite so simple as it seems initially. It's a great story. It's also wonderful writing about fascinating characters. Joseph is one of the spectacular figures in the whole Bible. Brilliant, talented, arrogant, gifted with remarkable vision and tremendous administrative skill both. He is a youth of extraordinary promise who becomes a man of fate and determination, one who survives enormous trauma to reshape 2 nations' intertwined destinies. A remarkably contemporary character, Joseph is a brazen, spoiled boy who grows into a subtle and deep man. It's not an easy process, but it begins with a bang in this week's portion of Vayeshev. At the commencement, our great ancestor Jacob's beloved wife Rachel has died in childbirth, giving birth to Benjamin, and in a pained overcompensation, Jacob spoils Rachel's oldest son Joseph, giving him a famous coat of many colors. Perhaps it's really an embroidered tunic, we don't know, but in any case, using Joseph as a tattletale spy on his older, tougher brothers. The brothers' revenge comes swiftly. Away from their father's eyes, they capture Joseph and sell him into slavery in Egypt, telling Dad that a wild animal has killed him. after adventures that demonstrate Joseph's newfound virtue and bad luck, too. This week's portion ends with Joseph stuck in an Egyptian prison, his father Jacob in mourning, and all hope seemingly lost. There are a couple of central messages in Vayeshev. The first is that we've heard in Genesis earlier, but is now reiterated poignantly, all our children are precious. Favoring the good one does no one any good. Treat each child with love, as though in fact each of our children was truly an only child in receiving your love. That's the Jewish way to parent successfully. The second and greatest abiding message of the Joseph story is that God's plan will work, but we aren't always party to how long it'll take. Transformation, moral and intellectual, first must occur. We struggle and sometimes suffer in order to learn what we probably should have known all along. God is the true source of all good and all understanding. For Joseph, his brothers, and his father, wisdom will prove hard won. Perhaps in reading Vayeshev, we can learn from their mistakes and so avoid the dramatic reverses of this great story. And then we ourselves may gain the wisdom to grow and change for the better. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Alan Marinus, founder of the modern Musar movement and author of a new book, The Shabbat Effect, explains how the Sabbath makes us better people. Find out and come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world, with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
The great Jewish, Czech-born, and very English playwright Tom Stoppard passed away last week at the age of 88. Beginning in 1966 in his 20s with his witty twist on Hamlet, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, he soon earned a reputation as the most cerebral of English language playwrights, venturing into vast fields of scholarly inquiry, theology, political theory, and so on, and spreading his work across the centuries and continents. Among Stoppard's best-known plays are The Real Thing, a Tony Award-winning tale of marriage of a playwright and an actress that considers the intersection of love and literature, the ribald comedy Arcadia, an Olivia Award-winning, that's the British version of the Tonys, which concerns human desire to acquire knowledge and the ways in which the most educated people misuse, misinterpret, and misunderstand it, and The Coast of Utopia, a trilogy devoted to an excitable Russian intelligentsia in 19th century Tsarist Russia, premiered in London back in 2002 and won the Tony on Broadway in 2007. Stoppard collected lots of Tonys. He won as well for his play Travesties. And most memorably, he got an Oscar for writing Shakespeare in Love. When he was a toddler, Tom Stoppard's family fled Czechoslovakia just ahead of Hitler, moving first to Singapore, then fleeing the Japanese there for British India. His father was killed in Singapore. His mother then remarried, and they moved on to England. Tom Stoppard did not know of his Jewish heritage until the 1990s, when he was in his late 50s. He went public with the news only in 1999. Stoppard's last play, Leopoldstadt, an Olivier and Tony Award-winning drama that traces the fate of a multi-generational Jewish family in Middle Europe during the first half of the 20th century, took Stoppard on his own personal history. In an apologia for a lifetime of obliviousness to the oppression and tragedy of his own relatives, he concludes the scene of a Tom Stoppard-like character, an escapee as a child from encroaching fascism, visiting the city of his birth. Learning the fates of so many of his ancestors, he breaks down and cries. Audience members often do so too, as he learns what he never knew. May Tom Stoppard's memory be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Alan Marinus, who is the founder of the Musar Institute and I think the guiding light, certainly one of, if not the most important guiding light in the modern Musar movement. And I'll have him explain what Musar is because not everybody understands, I'm sure. His new book is called The Shabbat Effect. We began to explore how certain techniques of Shabbat help us to kind of take control of our lives in a positive way earlier in the show. Alan, Musar was an obscure study area for a long time. It has now become popularized in large part through your work. Tell us what Musar is and what it means in the contemporary world.
There are many ways of being a Jew and many different focuses. And for some people, it's prayer. And for some people, it's Torah. And for some people, it's Tikkun Olam. And all of these are valid Jewish paths. The one path that I eventually came to in my own life within the Jewish fold came about because I was looking for something that would inform my inner life, my spiritual life, and the sense that I have of being a living being on the inside. And I stumbled over this tradition, which, as you said, was very obscure in our time, called Musar, which in fact dates back 1,100 years and certainly has roots going back right into the Torah and into the Mishnah. And the entire focus of Musar is on cultivating your inner life. It's really about saying your inner experience is your priority. No one can do that work except you. No one can develop your inner qualities and give you inner experiences except you. And here was a 11th century R&D department, as I call it, that was giving guidance on what to do with anger, what to do with patience, what to do with kindness, what to do with humility and arrogance and all the qualities that we experience inwardly. Here was a complete overview and detailed study of the human condition and how to work with it to bring about the most improvement and, in a sense, the most realization of your human potential that a person can hope for, especially within a Jewish frame and with Jewish definitions and Jewish goals. It was a completely Jewish approach to realizing your human potential. And that appealed to me a great deal because I was looking for a pathway to work on myself and to overcome habits and just that I had a sense of potential that wasn't being realized. And then the focus on Shabbat just carries that forward because in the book, the Shabbat effect, that effect I'm talking about is on the inner quality of the individual. And the book has 8 chapters, and each of those chapters focuses on a quality like joy, peace, trust, rest, etc., all of which are essential to the experience of a Shabbat, a real Shabbat, and then have an effect that is manifest the other 6 days of the week as well. When you learn how to be peaceful on Shabbat, you know how to be peaceful. And when you learn how to be satisfied with enough material possessions on Shabbat, because you don't shop and you don't build and you don't acquire, then you can become a content person on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Sunday as well. And so that's the Shabbat effect. And it is, again, bringing forward a Musar approach because it's focusing on the inner qualities that get developed through that exercise of observing a day of rest.
The ability to do that is part of sort of self-cultivation. That's really what Musar is about. Can you explain how Musar differs from, say, psychological analysis, therapy?
It differs and it doesn't. It is, I would say, just a wider frame that encompasses the psychological, because the big missing piece in the psychological that is of primary importance in Musar and in any Jewish approach is the spiritual. So psychology, through being forced into the educational system, the secular educational system, is very much aspiring to scientific status. And Musar doesn't have that aspiration. The Torah says in Leviticus, in no uncertain terms, what we're here to do when it says, you shall be holy, kedoshim tihiyu, you shall be holy. And that doesn't have a place in the world of psychology. In the world of psychology, you find all the inner experiences of the human condition, like I was listening, anger and peace and kindness and compassion and humility and arrogance and generosity, all that fits into a psychological frame and it fits into a Musar frame. But Musar has that larger view of saying, what for? Why? what is this all aiming towards? And psychology, it's about being functional, being happy, being well-adjusted, etc. In the Musser frame, drawing from Judaism, a much higher aspiration, which is to be holy. And that gives it a very different quality and a very different focus and purpose, which is distinctly Jewish. In fact, not just spiritual, but distinctly Jewish, because this is a aspiration that is woven into Jewish thought and practice right from the Torah. And when it says, you shall be holy, it doesn't say it once, it doesn't say it twice, it says it in a number of different ways in different places to emphasize that this is what we're here to do, to elevate the inner qualities, to refine the soul, to become the kind of people that some of our illustrious ancestors were in, and it's our potential as well. It's very similar because it's dealing with the human condition. It's very different because of the framework it brings to that inquiry.
Shabbat is a cessation from all regular work. There's a great deal of, I think, initial controversy in antiquity as Shabbat develops, so much so that the rabbinic Shabbat that we have is in many ways much more lenient than, say, what Ethiopian Jews did, you know, in which you were supposed to sit in the dark and eat cold food.
Mm-hmm.
How do we make a Shabbat for people that are so used to modern comfort and experience?
Well, there's nothing about Shabbat that needs to be uncomfortable. So having comfort is still possible. You know, we are actually blessed in the modern world with ways of being more comfortable than our ancestors were while still observing Shabbat, because we have things like electric timers, which are permitted on Shabbat. So you may not turn off and on your lights with your hand, but that doesn't mean your lights don't go on and off, or the warming tray for the food doesn't go on and off, or the heat doesn't go on and off. All of that can happen because we have the technology to do those sorts of things without breaching the rules and the purposes and the boundaries that Shabbat establishes. The world is very mundane. It's very defiled. It seems to be getting darker and dirtier by the moment. And we're people who are charged to be holy and to be a light unto the nations and to be the opposite of what we see happening in the modern world. And in order for that to happen in any way, there need to be boundaries. And so we live in a very unbounded society. If I want to do it and I want to do it now, I'll do it now. If I want to not vaccinate, I won't vaccinate. If I want to, you know, waste my money, I'll waste my money. There's just a very strong sense of individual right. And there is a cost to that. And the cost is no boundaries. And when there are no boundaries, how do you separate the mundane, if not the defiled, from the pure and the holy? It can't be. There has to be a practice of boundaries in order that we can hold firm to the inner sense I think most of us have, that the world should be a better place, and I should be contributing to that. I have some way my own life should be lifted up to a higher level. And that requires boundaries. And so when Shabbat comes around, it puts a limit on our exposure to the things that are not actually contributing to our own spiritual purity and well-being. And there are a lot of them in our world right now. And being able to and having a practice of drawing a line gives a person tremendous strength that applies, again, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It's interesting because you have to ask, even if you're not doing the same kind of work on that seventh day, is it not contributing to your work? Who works at their maximum potential who's working 24/7? Like, what happens to a human being who's working 24/7? In the book, I point out that the existence of a Shabbat, the institution of a Shabbat when it first came around, actually changed the definition of a human being. Because if all you do is work, then that's who you are. You're a productive tool. You're just a generator of wealth, and that's it. But then if one day a week you can't do that, then that raises the question, well, if I'm not entirely that, what am I? What is a human being if not a producer? And that institution of Shabbat changed the definition of a human being into being something more elevated, more comprehensive, more than just a donkey. But it took Shabbat to change our definition in that way.
There's an intentionality to Musar, but that's particularly true with Shabbat, isn't there? You have to kind of prepare. You have to constantly be aware of what it is you're trying to do.
Absolutely. Because you can observe a Shabbat that is 100% kosher, you could say, and without that intentionality, all it is you fulfill the checklist. It's just like the most mundane thing itself. And if there's no conscious intent to have it have an impact, then it's what the Torah commentator Rashi calls an incomplete Shabbat. He says we're meant to have a complete Shabbat. And a complete Shabbat is one where at the end of Shabbat, you're not the same as you were at the beginning. Something had an impact. There was some inner change. It could be small, it could be large, but you're not the same. You didn't go into Shabbat like that and came out of Shabbat exactly the same. And if you're living it just according to a rote checklist, then that missing piece of intentionality is going to have an impact on what the outcome is, and the outcome will be minimized by that.
I want to thank Dr. Alan Marinas for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about the Shabbat effect?
They can go to any of the regular book outlets to find my book. It's published by Bloomsbury, a major publisher, so it's on the Bloomsbury site, it's on Amazon, it's on every book platform. And then about Musar itself, the Musar Institute is now 21 years old, and you can find all the information at musarinstitute.org. And that's Musar with two S's, double S.
Alan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Stuart Weinblatt, chairman of the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition. Hanukkah's coming fast a week from tonight, Sunday, December 13th at sunset. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for this great festival of lights and latkes. It's a parody of the song Popular and other songs from the musical Wicked by 613 called, Hanukkah. My friends, may you enjoy a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Hanukkah, we celebrate Hanukkah. For each night from 1 to 8, we illuminate.
dreidel spinning skills us down. We say all the proper prayers and have gifts to share. Remember, it's the thought that counts.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.
Ma'usur Yeshua T helped us beat the Greeks. Nes Gadol Hayapo. Well, Shams. And that is why we want to have a happy Chanukah.